No, we're talking about the College of Scientists.
Now, this is very important. Let's get our minds on an order, get our ducks in a row, as it were. Talk about the question of, if we give it a somewhat philosophical statement, we point out that one's view of life, if he is logical, stands upon his view of origins. What we are is determined by where we came from. Fundamental question is man a cosmic accident, or is he a creation of God? If the former, if man is a cosmic accident, then he is autonomous and independent, answers only to himself, ultimately. If he is a creation of God, of a God, then his existence is derivative. He derives his existence from another. His existence is not self-existent. He is not self-existent. He is derivative, and therefore he is responsible. That's simple, isn't it? Now, let's see this big picture. I pointed out that there are only two possibilities: either some kind of evolutionary theory, or some kind of creation. There are no other possibilities. Unless you want to hold a man that the world as it is popped into existence as it is, which nobody holds. I mean, say nobody, but I'll become a freshman, dude. In the main, nobody does. Well, only, as the old philosophers say, there's only so many men in the room, there's so many ways to approach it. Now, therefore, if we do not accept creation, then we come to some kind of evolution. And there are three areas in which you have three problem areas of evolution. And we've tried to make this very clear. There is the question of the origin of matter itself. That's what we're coming to now. We've done this chronologically. It is the origin of matter. Second, there is chemical evolution or prebiotic evolution. Chemical / prebiotic. That is how this matter gets organized into life. And then there is biotic evolution, or amoeba to man, as sometimes it's popularly called. And these are really three separate areas, three separate problems. And to solve one is not to solve the other. Yes?
One question. Is origin of matter, origin of life, are they separate? Or is that
yes, it's separate, two separate questions. You cross the origin of matter is number one. The origin of life is number two. Chemical evolution as opposed to biotic evolution. In other words, in a cell, you have a living thing. It responds to stimulus, ingests food, reproduces itself. It's life. As opposed to just chemicals, ammonia and methane. As opposed to highly organized chemicals, polypeptides, so forth. Okay, y'all see that? And really, we have looked at the problems of the biotic evolution, have we not? Two primary problems of neo-Darwinism, of gradualism, and probabilities, and the absence of fossils. Now we come to, and we're going to look now at the first two. We looked at chemical evolution, the problem of chemical evolution. I listed the problems, and I enumerated those for you. Problem, the gap between protocells and cells, and the biases of the various chemicals that form left-handed or right-handed optically divided acids and so forth. Now we come to the ultimate problem, the question of the origin of matter itself. Which is the same question as what is the nature of the universe? What, when we look out there, what are we seeing? What is going on? Now, this is not in your syllabus, it will be in the revised syllabus. There are three basic problems in explaining the universe. Okay, you take good strong notes now, because this is really preliminary to what's in the syllabus. Now, and the problems, these three problems are to be are created by the fact of the second law of thermodynamics, that is, the normal process of the degradation of energy. The normal process is the degradation of energy. Energy degrades. In the light of the fact that energy degrades normally, that is, if there's not some kind of manipulation which can forestall it. In the light of the fact that energy degrades, anybody who's going to explain the universe has to cover three bases.
Before he is home.
Number one is the simple question of size. Since the size of the universe, number one, size.
Yes, size is the
element.
No. Wondering why he keeps sitting in the front row. The massacres, I suppose.
That is, the universe, in case you don't know it, is big. It's not really big. It's not that big, it is.
Yes, 1G.
It's not simply big, it is big. I mean, it is really big. Okay, I'll tell you how big it is. You should ask. The nearest galaxy to our galaxy is Andromeda. You know that in high school science. Our galaxy, we kind of call the Milky Way. Our galaxy is not our solar system now. Our solar system is the sun and the bodies that are around the sun. Our galaxy and our solar system is just a tiny, tiny speck of our galaxy. But the nearest galaxy to ours is Andromeda, which is 750,000 light years away. Light traveling at roughly the speed of 186,000 miles a second. So if you send a light beam or any object traveling for 186,000 miles a second at that rate, it would take 750,000 years to get there. That's just to the outer edge of Andromeda. A radio signal, if you had a friend on in one of the nearer planets in Andromeda, the Andromeda galaxy, you had a friend that you're going to talk by radio. You send a radio wave. And he got the message by radio then, and instantly returned it. Didn't mess around, didn't wait like a supper. He instantly answered you. You said, howdy, and he said, howdy. Back. Hey, Bloomer, he said, hey, back. By the way, how long would you have to wait for an answer? Now, a radio wave circles the Earth 8 times in a second. You know that? A radio wave circles the Earth 8 times in a second. That's how fast a radio wave travels. Okay. So if you send this radio wave at a rate that would circle the Earth at eight times every second, to this friend in Andromeda by radio. You didn't go yourself, you sent a radio wave. Talk with you. You got an immediate answer. How long would you have to wait for an answer? Between you said hey and you got a hey back. Anybody know? I don't want to guess. Since you don't know, I'll tell you.
How long would
you would only have to wait, as you ask, 1,500,000 years. So go ahead and eat. 1,500,000 years. If he sent it back immediately, a radio wave traveling at the speed of... You know, don't you, that the Voyager, this unmanned space, this vehicle is going out to the outer edge. Was it the Voyager or the outer edge of our solar system? The Voyager. Send back radio waves. Took several minutes for the radio waves to get here. And that's just on the edge of our solar system. That's just nowhere. Okay, the universe is big. Now, problem is of size. How is size a problem? Because the size of the universe keeps the universe from being drawn together, from being compressed by gravitational attraction. That is, if the universe were not so big, which is to say, if the bodies in the universe, the stars and the planets and the comets and everything, if they were not so far from each other, then the gravitational force would pull them together, and the universe everybody in the universe would simply be one alone. It's the size. Now, if you turn that around and look at it the other way, the question is, how did they get so far from each other? Since matter degrades, and since every body in the universe attracts every other body, especially on this campus, then the question is, how did it get so big? What we're saying is, when we look at the dimensions of the universe, we are looking at two things. In the light of the fact that matter degrades and every bit of matter in the universe attracts every other bit of matter. What we're asking is, as it touches the origin of matter, what kind of beginning did the universe have that enabled, that produced so much matter? And you realize that the Earth is just one of the smaller bodies of the universe. There are all kinds of things. And there are suns in the universe, which our sun and the Earth and all the distance in between could be embraced in the size of it. So the question is, what kind of beginning, number one, produced that much matter? And what kind of energy was involved to move the matter so far, to disperse it so widely that it does not collapse on itself? You understand that? It's a question of the quantity of matter and the distance of the matter that would, you understand, move it far enough apart from each other that the gravitational force between them is insufficient to pull it together. Yes.
So is the universe still expanding?
I said we're going to come to that later. That's one theory. I think it is. I think it is.
How could it be expanding and yet all the bodies attract?
It's like this. Good question. Thank you. Let's say I had a magnet the size of a marble, and another magnet. And I put them this close together, what's going to happen? Pull together. Okay. Now if I put them this far apart, will they pull together? No, maybe not. But if I put them in a vacuum, would they pull together? So there's no friction involved. Yes. Together. If I lay them on the table, the friction of the table would hold them. Put them in a vacuum, suspend them in weightlessness, they would pull together.
No matter how far apart they are,
there would be this attraction. However, if I take one of them, load it in a huge gun, question is, and I shoot it off into a vacuum space, the question is, how much gunpowder would I have to use to shoot it so that not only would it not collapse on itself, it would just keep going. That is, that the velocity of the second magnet would overcome the attraction between the two. So that it would never touch. What kind of energy are we talking about? You understand how much gunpowder, so that in this vacuum, not being unaided by friction, it would just keep going. That's what space is, it's a vacuum. Just keep going and going and going.
And then you multiply this on the number of times you have to multiply to get a whole universe. Okay, you understand? So the question is size, the origin of so much matter, and the distance apart from the matter.
If matter tends to degrade, then what kind of beginning, are you with me now, produced the size, that is, the amount of the matter and the distance between the matter that enables it to, that keeps it from collapsing on everything in the universe, collapsing on everything else? Okay, size, that's right. I don't want to get into answering too much. I'm simply talking about, if you're going to have a theory of the origin of the universe, this, your theory has to cover, explain the size of the second area. Whatever theory of the universe you're going to have of origins, the second area you have to cover is spin. Spins. One aspect. Spin. You see, everything in the cosmos spins on its own axis. Interesting. Everything in the cosmos spins on its own axis, for one, just to start with. Everything in the cosmos spins on its own axis, like this. The moon turns like this, the sun turns, the earth turns. You know what on its own axis means? Okay. Everything in the universe, everybody. Now, a comet doesn't. But that's not what I'm talking about. A comet is a piece of matter that's in orbit, depending on where it is and how fast it's going. A meteorite is garbage, but everything in the universe is in motion, but every spherical body, every planet, every star. You know there's a planet and a star, don't you? I'm not talking to myself. A planet is like the Earth, and a star like the Sun that creates its own imaging. You know, the Earth reflects light, the Sun produces it. But there are many things in between. There are quarks and some say black holes. There's two kinds. There are different arrangements of matter. But all the spherical arrangements of matter in the universe, whether it's solid gases or semi-solid gases or something like the Earth or pure hydrogen on fire like the Sun, then it spins on its own axis. Okay. Second, it takes the Earth 200 million years to make a revolution about the axis of the galaxy. Just as the Earth is spinning on a galaxy, on its axis, this is basic astronomy, I'm not an astronomer. But the Earth is spinning on its axis, of course. You look at it from above, the North Pole down, it's spinning. But it's a part of the galaxy, and the whole galaxy is spinning on an axis.
Where's the turn for anything?
And for the Earth to get around the axis of the galaxy, you can't see it much anymore because there's so much air pollution, but any of you ever really seen the Milky Way clearly? Out in the middle of the desert, out in the ocean somewhere, or some particularly freaking nature really clear to you, every one night. When I was a little boy, I used to sit all the time. I used to sleep outside all summer. I'd sleep outside from the rain. And no couch, no davenport, just all hanging out. For years, I slept out there. All this country boy. It's a great thing to sleep outside. Get it all there, keep the boogeyman away. I had a buddy of mine, we sit outside. One night in August was the best time of the year. We counted 50 shooting stars in less than half an hour. Mm-hmm. 50. That's the time of the year in August. But those nights you could just see the rim of the Milky Way. You know, it was like a big rim of a wheel, especially the big. Okay, so for the Earth to go around the axis of the galaxy, takes 200 million years. We haven't got far in our lifetime. The size of the galaxy. 200 million years. Okay? Now, what keeps the heavenly bodies in their path? Why is it that we can have clocks and calendars, predict time, calculate? Why is it that we can predict the motion of the heavenly bodies so exactly that when we shot them into the moon, you understand that when we shot them into the moon, we didn't aim at the moon. You can't do that. You can't just aim at the moon like a rifle. You know, get the guy. I was watching a picture. Go to the moon. Okay, get a guy in front of the steering wheel. You know, and fire off that booger, and he just keeps his eye on the moon and he just steers toward it. Now, you have to calculate exactly what you do is, the move this way, they went off this way, they fired off this way, went around the Earth and into an orbit. So, and then when they got calculated just right, when they calculate the motion of the moon, they fire out of the Earth orbit so that when it comes around this way, they would meet. That's why the margin of error is very slim. For instance, one of the problems, one of the calculating errors, this is interesting to you, when they try to capture a satellite with the space shuttle, they don't just shoot that thing up and then steer to it. You can't do that. You see, when at those speeds, to change course at those speeds takes an unbelievable amount of energy. The higher speed you go, the more energy it takes to change course. So what they do is, and you can be in an orbit. If you're in a different orbit, you can come within 10 feet or 10 inches of the, or what you're trying to line up with, so that it's in orbit too. And at that orbit, never touch it, never get near it, enough to capture it. You have to be on exactly the same orbit. You understand? Calculate mathematically, get exactly the same orbit. Because what happens is, if you think you're here and it's up here, you're just going to run behind it and snare it. You can't do that because you'll go like this. See? You understand that? So you just can't aim at the thing. It's an unbelievable calculation. And so the calculations that enabled the Voyager, for instance, to go where they wanted it to go, it's unbelievable. By the way, it could never have been done without computers. It would take hundreds of thousands of mathematicians, centuries, with pencil and paper to work out the mathematical calculations for space, for near space shot to hit it. You understand? It's simply the maths. With a computer can do it this, for a short period of time. Now, so that what gives the universe this predictability? As it's one thing to say, listen, it's one thing to say that we look at the universe, we see matter in motion. But you see, you can have all kinds of matter in motion. But we have matter in predictable motion, systematic motion. It's not just carrying off here and there and all kinds of wild. It's not like swinging on a golf ball in a tile bathroom. You hear about the guy that did that, 47 bruises and a concussion. You swing on a golf ball in a tile bathroom, and you're like, you got matter in motion, but who knows where that fella's going to go? Well, if you can work it out and have the map and figure all the angles, and then you might be able to predict it, but in chaos. No, we have predictable motion, systematic motion. And listen to me, what keeps the orbits, what keeps the moon in orbit? It is the balance of centrifugal force and magnetic force. Simple as that. That is, there has been established an equilibrium between centrifugal force and magnetic force. The magnetic force keeps it from flying, keeps the moon from flying off into space, and the centrifugal force keeps it from hitting the Earth. You understand that? You know what centrifugal force? You've done this as a kid. You take a string. When I was a little boy, it was a big trick in our days to take a bucket. You ever take a bucket of water and you swing it over your head? And that was a big thing, And I thought I was doing a big house up in my life. I went down to get the eggs. And I had half a bucket of eggs. I was swinging the eggs, walking up from the chicken house. And I forgot there was a clothesline there. And I walked right into the clothesline. And the view was the physical force stopped. And gravity took over. And it rained eggs. Well, you should have heard me explain that to my mother. Well, the centrifugal force stops in gravity, but you see the centrifugal force outmoded the gravity and kept the eggs in the bucket or walking on the clothesline. Now, so it maintains the distances of separation in our solar system. You get that? The equilibrium of centrifugal force and magnetic force maintains the equilibrium in our universe so that we know where the sun is going to be in relationship to the Earth. We can calculate it unless something changes radically different. a million years from now, 10 million years from now, 10 million years ago. By the way, ancient historians use this to calculate time, because some of the real mileposts, which are real definite chronological anchors, are eclipses of the sun in various parts of the world. If you get somebody eclipse of the sun, all you have to do is figure out where he was when he saw it. And you can tell the exact day by our calendar that he saw it. An eclipse, and it says the guy was in Greece and saw an eclipse of the sun. And we can tell exactly the day of the month that he saw it.
As long as we have some semblance of that, year was.
No.
Well, I guess he might be
within a half century.
He's going to have to be within
a half century. You know, because that just depends on that. Some of our, by the way, our absolute dates come from the eclipse of the sun. We can calculate them. Not only predictable. Now, so this predictability, this equilibrium that I'm talking about is a function of spin. What can the eggs in the bucket spin? Okay. Now, listen to me. Any theory of the origin of matter, any theory of the universe, has to explain its size. It has to explain spin. Because the universe is not simply in motion, it's in a particular kind of motion. Just because something is flying out doesn't mean it's going to spin, understand? Just that matter of motion doesn't make it spin. By the way, this is good ballistics. What makes a rifle bullet travel straight? You can aim the thing. It's the spin. In the old days, the old smooth bore rifles, they didn't know where that thing was going, but the guy shot it wasn't safe. If you know, they picture, you see some of the movies, some of the old frontier movies, back in the smooth bore rifles, and they'll picture guys shooting these incredible shots and picking off a twig. That is not true. That was a piece of luck. Those things, you see, be the very best shot that you were. And you could get a straight shot. You could really hit the bullseye at a long distance if you had three things, had a steady hand. Your rifle, which was, you know, in the days when they processed most of their corn into a liquid form, if you had a steady hand. Secondly, if you had a straight barrel, which was very hard to get in those days because they made barrels by, it had a rod and wrapped the metal around the rod and pull out the rod, that's how they got a barrel. And that's a very tricky method. The third is, if your rifle ball was perfectly round, and you got a good charge of dry powder, then the thing would go straight. Very few rifle barrels were exactly straight, it was pure luck if you got a perfectly round ball out of the mold. Everybody made their own mold. Heat lead, pour it in the mold. I see. Here's the mold. I see. And it was just pure luck if you got one perfectly round. By the way, we had the same problem even ball bearings. That's one of the things they want in space technology. Only in space can you get a perfectly round sphere because gravity warps it. The best ball bearing you can buy, man, on Earth is not round. And I make them round. You understand? Because gravity warps it. This enough. Anyway, you, isn't that true? You might listen about this stuff, but they're true. So that it will everything affects. Oh, that is why a baseball curves. Because it doesn't spin. You spin a baseball, it will go straight. I mean, spin it this way. It curves because you spin it this way. Which puts unequal pressure on it. That's why it drops. But anyway. Now, when they first learned to rifle barrels, they got away from the round ball to the shape we now know it has. And by the way, ideally, in a good rifle, the bullet never touches the barrel. It's its spin from the air. Goes through the rifle is in a barrel spinning inside the air. But when this rush of air, since the air is spinning in the air, sends the rifle spinning. It doesn't rub against the sides of the barrel. It doesn't touch the side. The air keeps it away, and the air starts to spin. Anyway, now so that, but you see, you can shoot a missile And just the fact that you shot it doesn't make it spin. You get an explosion. You don't get spin automatically out of an explosion when the parts fly off. For a rifle barrel or a bullet to spin, therefore it goes straight, or it has to be made to do so. That's my point. So that you have to explain the spin of the universe. Now, sub consideration of this, let me point out that there are in our solar system, not out there in the universe somewhere, or in the galaxy somewhere, in our solar system, there are various anomalies. What's an anomaly? Something doesn't fit the system of spin. Now, that is, the sun and Jupiter have more than one rotation rate. They spin faster at the center than they do at the poles because they're semi-fluid. You know that? Because it's semi-fluid, the sun spins faster at the center than it does at the poles. Because what happens is, because it's not completely solid, because of the added weight, it will spin faster at the middle, but near the poles, the matter is not enough weight to carry it, so it lags behind. It's like a semi-liquid or something. It's interesting, isn't it? One of the real problems that every body has when it deals with is that Venus rotates in the wrong direction of its axis in relative to the ecliptic. That is, Venus spins backwards in relation to every other planet in our solar system. You think about that. It spins backwards. The sun rises. Venus goes around our sun. That's the same sun we do. But if you were on Venus, the sun would rise in the west. It goes the other way. It's interesting. almost every theory of the beginning of our solar system says that the Earth and everything are originally part of the major bodies, were originally parts of the sun that spin off. But the sun's spinning in this direction, and something spins off, which is going to be going in the same direction. And that's fine if you come to Venus, and it's going in this direction. Somebody could have thought of reverse.
How do they explain? That's
a good question. Uranus, listen, and perhaps Pluto. Now, not only does Venus spin backwards, Uranus, and some think Pluto, we're not sure, spins, listen to me, with its axis pointing at the sun. You got this? Here's the sun. The Earth spins this way. Venus spins this way. And Uranus spins this way. So that their North Pole is the hot area, and their equator is the coldest. Pluto may do that too. And then, added to that, each of the heavenly bodies has what we call moons, these satellites. And the satellites are not in the ecliptic. That is, the satellites, you see, if they all spin off the moon, off the sun, then the Earth would pick up the spin of the sun. And then what spun off the Earth, the moon spun off the Earth, you know, it would be in the same plane. Except that the satellites of the various bodies are in all kinds of orbits. They're not on the plane. It would be like with Venus. It would be like this. Suppose you spun. If you send a frisbee, say you throw it, a spin. Right? You spin it this way. And what would you think if you took a frisbee and with your strong right arm you flung it this way and immediately started going this way? You'd have to go back and rewrite all the books of basic physics. That'd be wrong. Last of all, do you have probably one planet spinning. You know, this is just our solar system. Just our solar system. One planet spinning backward, at least one spinning on its axis toward the sun, spinning up and down, as it were, in relation to the sun. Well, not exactly. Mm-hmm. And you have irregular satellite motion. There are variable spin rates throughout the universe, throughout the solar system, I mean. Why? It's interesting. One of the reasons, one of the many thousands of reasons why life is possible upon Earth, life as we know it, as they like to say, is the spin rate of the Earth. What would happen if the Earth slowed down just a hair? The spin rate.
Not enough to be a major,
is that
a whole it becomes a supernova. I'm really talking about more than that. Or all of a sudden we get stronger,
the Earth would burn up and freeze. Because of the spin rate, the Earth, just as the side of the Earth, which is the coldest, gets so cold, we start life, we start to die, then the sun comes up and it warms it up. Just as in many parts of the Earth, it's just getting so warm that the sun, we cook everything, the sun goes down. And it allows, the sun and the Earth is just the right distance from the Earth, from the sun, and spins at just the right rate. That there is a zone on Earth in which it never gets too hot or too cold, which is one of the basic reasons why there's no life on any other planet in the solar system, either too hot or too cold, which is determined by spin rate around the sun. Suppose the Earth shone on one side of the Earth 40 hours without stopping, and then it was cold for 40 hours, no sun for 40 hours. The life as we know it would not exist. And I mean, you still have the other planets. So that there's a spin rate, but the question.
Okay, what if we had, say, a 30-hour day?
I don't know. It would mess everything up. The weather and everything. Now, the problem is, not only is the Earth, fortunately, have just the right spin rate, in our solar system, there are variable spin rates. You see, no two bodies spin at the same rate. Mercury and Venus, for example, are very slow. Mercury and Venus are very slow. That's why they are very slow life there. Well, that's the only reason for the life there. They're very slow. And one of the strangest things is that Jupiter, and this is really an anomaly, Jupiter, which is the biggest planet, you would expect the biggest, the most mass, to spin the slowest. Jupiter, as a matter of fact, spins the fastest. Jupiter has an 11-hour day. Venus, it's not how long Venus is, but well, the others have longer, most of them have longer days. Jupiter has an 11-hour day. I mean, you get through a year in a hurry, and Jupiter spins the fastest, which is the most massive. Okay, those are just the major problems. So what am I teaching you? I'm teaching you that any view of the universe must address the size of it in terms that I've given, the energy required for that, so it doesn't collapse. Secondly, the spin of the universe. And last of all, I've already hinted at it with my little analogy of shooting the marble-sized missile, is energy. Size, spin, and energy. Now, energy is frankly little understood. What kind of energy is available in the universe? Not simply sunlight, sun energy. There are nuclear fires, such as around the sun. There are quasars, pulsars, exploding galaxies. Energy is a little understood phenomenon. It is not homogeneous. It is not uniform. It is problematic and amazing. A star, in case you don't know it, is a magnificent furnace. The Earth, the Sun is a star. It's an amazingly efficient furnace. Kind of like this planet that way. What happens in a star like the Sun? Well, what happens is that lightweight nuclei are forced together at high temperatures
to form heavier nuclei, which are more stable, but they have a total amount of energy less than its components. You see, all that basically what's going on in the sun is that heavy nuclei are jammed together and lighter nuclei form heavier nuclei, and there's a leftover energy. The sun, you understand, the heavier one doesn't equal the sum of whatever is embraced in it. And what's left over, we call heat energy, keeps us warm. It's the leftover energy. Heavy nuclei, lighter nuclei become heavy. This is the simplest explanation. This is of it. Now, there are different kinds of fusion. One of the reasons this thing has happened in Russia, Chernobyl or whatever the name of that place is, that is one of the least efficient kinds of fusion and one of the most dangerous because it leaves a residue of radiation, high energy particles, called radiation. And there's another kind of fusion. It's called theoretically there's another kind of fusion that does not leave radiation, but burns it. I'll think of it later. There are many kinds of fusion. I'm not a physicist, so I'm limited to my knowledge of this, of course. Now, energy, as I've said, is balanced by gravity in the universe. That is, not just keeping the planets away from each other, it keeps the sun from collapsing on itself. Keeps the sun from exploding as energy is expended. Of course, why doesn't the sun just blow up? There's all that heat there. Why doesn't the thing just go blue once? And that's the end of it. The answer is that the matter in the universe, every body of matter attracts every other matter. Force of gravity of that burning matter keeps it together. Very beautiful system, isn't it? Now, what will happen? Will it blow up? You say, well, when the mass, someday, the Lord, if things don't change, the sun will blow up. The sun is consuming matter, matter is being degraded. There's less sun now than there was when I started this sentence. Why? What's happening? It's being going out, it's being dissipated. Eventually, when the matter in the sun gets to the point where there's not enough gravity attraction to hold it, and if assuming there's that much heat energy going on, it will explode. Or if there's not enough heat energy, it will just get cold. Whichever goes first. If the gravity energy, if that balance goes first, the blow up, if the heat energy goes first, the matter become a cold lump. Some say the world ended in fire, some in ice. Robert Frost says.
What will cause the gravity to decline?
The matter is simply not enough matter there to overcome heat energy. Let me give you an analogy of this, Alan. Did you ever try to if any little kids take a firecracker and put it inside of a tin can and make the tin can go up in the air? You take a little tin can, blow the hole in, put a firecracker in, and light it. Then you get ambitious and you try to get it. It's in a great big can, So you get this big can and you the firecracker light it and it goes boom. It sits there. Why? Not enough energy to overcome the gravity. But suppose the can, we have the same firecracker, and the can oxidizes, withers away, it maintains its basic structure. So there's not enough there, eventually the same amount of energy will. That's kind of a rough analogy. But depending on, but now if you lose too much heat energy, it'll just sit there and a little rust and just fall into itself. That's kind of a rough illustration. It's the balance of energy and gravity. Okay. Now, as energy is expended, leaving only matter, the force of gravity creates total collapse. What is this total collapse called, by the way? Anybody happen to know? If all heat energy is lost, leaving the matter, leaving nothing but gravity, what is it called?
The third black hole.
Black hole. theory of the black hole. Why is it just a theory? Can't see it. Why can't you see them if they're there?
One invisible.
It's gravity power. Gravity is so strong, we don't let light.
Well, the light waves out. It sucks the light waves in, and matter increases into a black. So that matter, and it increases heavy gravity. It pulls all the matter near anything close enough to it. It's not, doesn't have enough energy to overcome it. A velocity, outward motion. It collapses in on itself. So that. Their presence is calculated mathematically by the effect on the star, on bodies around this the intense gravity on the path, the orbits of bodies around it, they can calculate and guess that they're there. You can't see them, but no light escapes.
It just becomes unimaginably difficult.
A black hole is a minor collapse of the universe. Theoretically, if the Big Bang theory and the expanded universe theory is correct, now theoretically it could be correct, but if it is correct, then all the matter in the universe, with all of its weight, in other words, you took all the matter in the universe, all the suns, all the comets, all the dust, every planet, every star, and you put it on a scale, what would it weigh? Well, anyway, that all the, now really weight is just gravitational force. You understand? That's why you weigh less on the moon, less gravity, because the moon's smaller. That's why you weigh at the end of the high jump on the moon. Okay, but if you pick the, that if it were all that at one time, all this matter existed or could have existed or could exist with all of its weight in a lump, we would call it, the size of which would be so small that if I could hold it up, I could hold it in the palm of my hand, and you could not see it with the naked eye. All the matter of the universe be compressed with infinite weight, infinite density, to one point that's so small it could not be seen with the naked eye. Theoretically, it could go into infinite density, it could not be seen. Well, that means you're in Genesis. And what a black hole is just one tiny section of that matter. The heat energy is lost because it's close enough to other pieces of matter. There's nothing, it's a vacuum. There's nothing to keep it apart, so it collapses in. So, into this infinitely dense matter, pulling its grid, gravitation. Let's take our break on that. Now, a couple more points on energy. What are the three things any view must explain? Size and energy. The amount of energy, this is interesting, in space is variable. It's not even. In fact, it is so uneven that there are stars that fit no existing model whatever. There are stars in the universe that don't fit any laws of physics. There's no rhyme or reason. For instance, there's one star called the Purple Pleiades. Ever hear of the Purple Pleiades? It spins very fast and is of such high energy that it sends out spirals of reddish hydrogen forming belts around it. Spins off hydrogen, actually the specific of course spins off hydrogen belts around it, making it look purple on Earth. There's no reason in the world to explain such a high spin rate. I mean, it is going to happen. I think every a day on it is something like, I don't know, a couple of seconds. No, not that much. Yeah. It's just a few minutes. Just unbelievably high. So, you know, it's going so fast that it's spinning a semi liquid to my foot, spinning off hydrogen. This is the language of the heavier gas. It spins off the heavier gases. Well, there are many other things I can tell you. Some of the computer enhanced pictures that come from outer space are fabulous, absolutely beautiful. The beauty of the colors. Now, having said that, with that as an introduction, we come to the various theories of the origin of matter, page 22, and the organization of the universe. We're looking at two things. Origin is organization.
We did the organization, or maybe another part of this, I'm going to get into any discussion as to life outside of Earth.
Yes, yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Okay.
This course is the history of logic of science. Well, the oldest scientifically proposed theory was the nebular hypothesis. It was held by some in the days of Galileo, believe it or not. It was the prevailing scientific view, quote unquote, in the 18th, 19th, and early part of this century. Immanuel Kant, for instance, held in 1775, the year before the American Revolution. It is used in elementary school textbooks because it is so simple to demonstrate.
Still?
Yes. Aspects of the nebular hypothesis are still used because it is simple, and textbook writers like to keep things simple. It is incorporated in many explanations of the origin of various objects within the cosmos. The nebular hypothesis, while it is no longer the prevailing view of the whole universe, the concept is used to explain various parts of the universe, various aspects of the universe. What is this? Number four, here's the basic concept. I've got it for you. Various objects that we see in space have their origin in a spinning blob of matter, which, as it contracts through the force of gravity, increases its angular velocity to conserve momentum so that it spun faster and faster. That is, as it contracted, it got heavier and began to spin faster. And as it spun faster, the centrifugal force spun various chunks of solidified matter or dense gases into the various objects of the universe. Here's the physics of this, basically, as I understand it. Remember I told you that the sun, the force of the gravity, has so much matter in it, so dense, that the gravity keeps it from exploding, the energy keeps it from collapsing. It's degrading. According to this theory, this initial blob of matter, it contracted because of the force of gravity, therefore got heavier and spun faster. You see, as it got smaller. Oh, that's the principle of gears. How can a car pick up speed? So you transfer the motion of a large gear to a smaller gear, and it goes around faster. That's some of the physics we're talking about here. Anyway, this blob, while the gravity was sufficient to keep it basically together, the force, the velocity created by the increased spin allowed various parts of it to break off and spin off. The sun, for instance, as this is applied to our solar system, it was written that Earth was always a part of the sun, this was Venus and Pluto, all this. And the whole thing didn't fall apart, but various chunks spun off. The nebular hypothesis, that's what it's called. Now, the modern version suggests that eddies formed in the rotating cloud and thus concentrated matter in various places at various distances from the center. Since eddies can curve in virtually any direction, this would explain such things as the backward rotating planets like Venus. Got that? These anomalies were eddies in this spin-off. Now, what do we say about this? Well, first of all, it does not address the question of the origin of matter. It starts with something. It's interesting that somebody's pointed out that most textbooks, and they do, you look at the wording, they say, it's a little humorous, you read it,
before people pick up on it, they'll say, title of this section, the beginning of the origin of matter. And then we'll start out, there most certainly was this, and fill in the blank, original blob, original chum. And very few people notice that they have not explained the origin of matter. They've explained the action of matter. But to explain the action of matter is not to explain the origin of matter. Or, to use the language of our syllabus, to explain the organization of matter is not to explain its origin. But you see this time and time again, and I've seen this. You see what I'm saying? They'll say, okay, now we're going to talk about the origin, the beginning. They start out, there was this. This doesn't explain the beginning. It assumes the beginning. And the Nebular Hypothesis does not address the origin of matter. All it does is talk about how matter might have acted after it was here. That's a very important thing. And many people are to think, kids at school think, oh, the Nebular Hypothesis, or any of you, explains the origin of matter. It doesn't. The variable and the variable masses and spin rates of the planets do not fit the predictions of the theory. The usual motions of some planets and the low density composition of such massive bodies as Jupiter also do not fit the model. Pluto's highly inclined orbit is especially difficult to fit this theory. And there are other objections. So the theory is pretty well forgotten, and it's in as a theory that explains the whole universe. Not its origin, but its organization. It doesn't even attempt to explain the origin of matter. So, while it is no longer used to explain the organization of the whole universe, it is used to explain the organization of various parts of the universe. The Nebular Hypothesis. But, it just doesn't work. Second, there is a planetesimal hypothesis. And this came into being around 1900. Remember I said the Nebular Hypothesis held in the 18th, 19th, early part of the 20th century? Well, it began to lose credibility. And by the way, one of the things that caused it to lose credibility was the development of some of these huge telescopes. That like Palomar and various observatories, which gave us a better look at the universe. And this has been enhanced by the space program, which enabled the equipment to get beyond the haze, the obstruction of the atmosphere, to look comparatively unobstructed view. That was one of the reasons it was so unfortunate that Challenger 7 blew up, one of the loss of light, the loss of stability. Now, and so what I'm saying is that as the Nebular Hypothesis began to develop these big, the better math and more study and better observation, Nebular Hypothesis and some of these problems were recognized as being so overwhelming. Men began to look for another explanation. And they admitted that it did not explain the origin of matter. Now, by the way, let me say this to you, that if you spring this on some modern skeptic, they will say, well, now we know that matter, there is no fine line, which is true. No absolute line between matter and energy. So the origin of matter is energy. Aha, so there. Well, we're back to the question of turtles now. What is the origin of energy? What I'm saying is that the question of origin of matter and the origin of energy is the same question. We're talking about the question of origins. You see, the fundamental philosophical question is, why should there be something instead of be nothing? Why should something exist rather than nothing exist? It's the fundamental question of philosophy, the first question of philosophy. And the secular, of course, the Christian answer is God. The secular answer is, why not? Why should something exist rather than nothing exist? Why not? The source, around 1900, T.C. Chamberlain, an American geologist, and F.R. Moulton, an American astronomer, proposed an alternative to the Nebular Hypothesis.
which is the alternative name, the planetesimal hypothesis. The basic concept is this, that an intruder star from somewhere else in our galaxy came near the sun. As it did, the gravitational forces that were generated produced tidal forces that poured material out of the sun, which became the solar system. You got that? That is, the Earth didn't spin off the sun in the natural course of its spinning, as in the nebular hypothesis, that, because that really creates problems, that some this wayward star, or overgrown comet or something, came near enough the sun, the gravitational force of it pulled off chunks of the sun, and they spun off into space, forming the solar system. What do we think about that? Well, as I point out, virtually all the objections noted for the nebular hypothesis apply to this model. Same problems. Got that? Problem of spin, all the rest. It does not address, again, the question of the origin of matter. And it was not considered seriously by most astronomers and never has been. I just put it in because it wasn't significant enough to get it in there. It was popular. It was a fad for a while, mainly because it was an alternative to the nebular hypothesis. Then came the famous Big Bang theory, which is a trivialized Big Bang. It's not really fair to the theory. It's like what Kennedy did to the Strategic Defense SID. He called it Star Wars, and the newspapers picked it up. It's been Star Wars ever since, which really is a trivializing of the concept. And Big Bang is really a trivializing of it. You understand that? That's kind of it puts a slant on it, a twist, or you forget the pun, spin, which is anomalous. Anyway, it is the most commonly used explanation of the origin of the cosmos. It is the most viable at the present time. It is the prevailing view, Big Bang. Did you ever read DeJastro's book, God and the Astronomers? He presents as simplified an explanation as I've ever read of the Big Bang. What the Big Bang says is that, remember I said we're talking about black holes, that we know it's possible. What it says is that the whole universe at one time was, all the matter in the universe was compressed into one point of infinite density, infinite weight, infinite mass, and then some source of energy, whether from without that point of mass or compressed energy, whatever you want to call it, or something within it, some force, unexplained force within it, that it blew up, and these gases became solidified into matter, and the universe is still blowing up, hence it is expanding. And this is established by the famous red shift, that is, it's recognized that light traveling away from us. One of the things you look at the heavenly bodies is to know, you understand, we're not seeing them as they are, we're seeing as they were in various times in the past. And secondly, because it takes not so much time to get the light to get here. Secondly, it's hard to know what direction they're traveling in. But because someone discovered a long time ago that light shifts toward the red end of the spectrum as it moves away from it, from the point of vision, that this is used to substantiate the theory of the expanding universe, that everybody, every piece of matter, every heavenly body, star, quasar, and so forth, is moving away from every other body as trivial speed. And the farther you go away from us, the faster the speed. So the Big Bang expanding universe theory. By the way, this thing, the red shift, is not too complicated. Do you ever stand in a crossing and hear a train go by and the whistle blowing? It sounds high and low. Ooh, you hear that? Why does the train whistle sound louder when it's coming closer to you? Coming toward you and softer, lower pitch. What's going away from you?
The sound is going away from you.
Because
Well, because the sound waves, when they're coming towards you, so only the distance, what makes tone is the difference, is the distance between the waves. And the distance between the waves is compressed with the fact that the source is moving this way. The train is moving this way, compressing. So it's, oh, it's going, so every time a sound wave is in, the train moves, so it compresses it. So the sound waves are closer together. So it sounds like a higher tone. But when it's going that way, they're farther apart because the source of sound is moving away from you. So there's more gaps between the sound waves. Therefore, if the sound, if you're standing still, the train is standing still in one tone. It's higher and lower. But the light shift is like that. And because when it's moving away from you, you don't have the source of light, but the light waves are farther apart, shifting toward the radial scale. That's the basic principle. Yes?
Now, everything in the universe is in motion from this explosion. Are they moving away from each other, or are they all moving away from one point?
It's a good question. They all seem to be moving away from each other. Nobody knows where the point is, if that where it was.
So there's nothing that's moving towards it?
No. Couldn't be. See, it can only be moving away at a slower rate. Not be moving towards us.
Oh, yeah.
Because you see, in this event, if we're here, if something's here and we're here, and this is the source over here, it may be going in the same direction towards in that sense. But see, we're moving away from it.
Yeah, I was.
That's what I mean by that. Towards is right. You understand? We're not getting closer. And everything that's out here is moving at a faster rate than there, so it's getting farther from us at an increased rate. Good question. You understand my answer? Okay. Now, I'm not buying this. I'm simply saying this is the theory. It is the prevailing theory, and I'm trying to give you the arguments for it. Let's look at it here. All that we see is the result of an ancient explosion of a primeval blob of matter. Matter was sent flying out into space in all directions. Those pieces nearest the edge of the blob were thrown out the fastest and the farthest. Those objects the most distant from the explosion center traveled the fastest. Which is true of explosion, by the way, it's true. That is, if you stack up out here in this field a pile of 15 tons of bricks, and right in the very center of that, you had a huge charge of dynamite, and you set it off. You would, when the dust settled, you would not have an even circle of brick dust. That is, you would not have all the matter blown the same distance, even though it was subjected to the same, you had one charge, not why. Because those on the outer edges, that's the nature of explosion, those on the outer edge of this pile would go way out. And those that were near the center of the charge would not go as far. That's the nature of it, not all the physics involved. So it seems to fit. Now, by the way, and Jastrow, in his book God and the Astronomers, he raises the question of what existed in that infinitesimal moment of time before the explosion. That is, he points out that the Big Bang Theory does not explain the origin of matter either. It just starts with matter being unbelievably condensed. But it starts with matter, does it not? It starts with something, starts with matter. And he raises the question, he's not a believer, he's not a Christian. He raises the question as both God and the astronomers. If, and he accepts the Big Bang, the expanding universe, he says that he raises the question, what existed that, in other words, it's like this, if you can picture the universe and what's gone on since the beginning of whatever beginning you're going to talk about, and run it like running a film backwards, you would have it condensing, you run the film backwards, condensing, until it got down to this point of infinite mass, infinite density, infinite weight. And he raises the question, well, what existed 1 millisecond or 1 millionth of a millisecond? It's my language, not his. Before the explosion.
And then secondly, what was the source of the energy that caused the explosion? And what he says is what we're dealing with here is God. Now, he points out, listen to me, this is the importance of the Big Bang Theory, that what the Big Bang Theory really says is that the universe had a beginning. A definite beginning. Matter as we know it has not always been here. Matter as we know it has not always been here. Understand that? Therefore, it had a beginning. Well, and Jasper also points out that as the Big Bang Theory began to gamma out, and the others began to work on the Big Bang Theory, they were using Einstein's mathematics. And Einstein himself resisted the conclusion of his own theory of relativity, because the theory of relativity, taken to its logical conclusion, requires a beginning for the universe. And he points out how many whose primary works, such as Einstein's math, how it pointed to this, that they didn't like this, because you see, the question is, you don't have eternal matter, you've got eternal God, or something behind eternal matter. And they didn't like this idea. He points out in this present day, what he's saying, the main point of this book, as I understand it, I've read it before, is that there ought not to be the kind of prejudice that stalled this thing for a while, and men ought not to resist it, but they ought to honestly raise the question, did the universe have a beginning? And what was the beginning? That is, what existed the infant, that moment, however large moment you want to posit, what existed that moment before the bang? This is where he makes this famous statement, and I'm paraphrasing it, I have the book, that the scientists, modern scientists, may be like men who are climbing a mountain of knowledge, trying to discover the ultimate knowledge, the question of origins, real origins, to be somewhat redundant, original, or ultimate origins, which is redundancy. And these scientists are like these mountain climbers climbing the mountain of investigative research and knowledge, and they find they get near the top, they're going to find the answer, and they struggle over the last cliff, the last rock outcropping, finally at the top, and lo and behold, they find a bunch of theologians sitting there, and they've been there for centuries. That is, what he says is, what Jastrow says, Jastrow works with the Goddard Institute over here, one of our leading astrophysicists and scientists, he says, our man and our scientists may be taken as two geniuses. And we are. Great. That's the point of the book. That's what the book is saying. Our science may be taken as two theology. That we may just work through our science and work out what the theologians have known all along, and what was what? In the beginning, God created. That's the significance of Jasper. He has no conclusion, he just raised his book, just raises the question. Now, but he bases it on the Big Bang theory, which says the universe has a beginning. The matter as we know it has. Y'all seen that? How many of you have read the book? How many of you wrote it through your research paper? Did you have any comments? You read it there for recently, more recently than I have. Any comments you want to add?
Basically, what it says.
Yeah, I'm better to show here.
I was looking for the quote in my notes.
It's in the back, it's very end of the book, as I recall.
It's on the cover also.
It is?
It's in the last parts of the book.
You know, look at what it's called. Robert Jastrow, God and the Astronomers.
Very interesting.
So if you want to look at the Big Bang Theory, I recommend that book as the most straightforward, simplified look at it. I'm not saying I buy the Big Bang Theory, I'm simply saying I think it's significant, very interesting. We'll still at the bottom of page 22. It seems to fit with observations. Note that, ununderlined, seems to fit with observations. A few problems remain unresolved. That is, it doesn't answer everything. For instance, it doesn't really answer the spin, some of these questions of spin, various rates of spin. It doesn't answer a whole lot. Does if what we see is a result of a primeval explosion, it seems to have been, in my opinion, a very guided explosion, a manipulated explosion, because you don't see the kind of randomness that you expect from an explosion. There's too much system. And they admit this. And again, it does not address the origin, the question of the origin of matter, which is Jastrow's point. The Big Bang points to the question, but it does not answer the question. You still start with that point. Question of origin, and that's the solution to that. We're going to stop there for today. I've got to get to the plane. So I'm going to let you go. Hard to fly.
What do you do when you catch one?
Hold on.
Have a good weekend. It's about 6 minutes before the other. How much time do you have this morning?
10.
I'm going to have to go. I'll give you 15 minutes.
You preach in
the day. Go quietly because other pastors are still in session.
You preach this week in the north?
I've got a family seminar.
We'll have those tests in our box,
right? And that's it. That becomes the habit of your life, actually. Then you walk in darkness. Now, this does not mean that along the way, I may, for one reason or another, disregard you. I may meet you in the hallway. My mind is occupied, and I walk right by as though you didn't. We didn't even meet in the hallway, and I don't speak, and you say, Paul. I've been ignored by part of people before, so I don't know why he thinks that one comes up. See, that doesn't mean that. But what it means is you're continually. See, I acted as though you didn't even exist. When I was in your presence, I would just eliminate you from conversation, eliminate you from concern. If you had a real need, and I knew you had a need, and I had the means to meet that need, and I didn't meet it, as if you didn't. See, that's what the settle involves. And so the person now maintains that he's in fellowship with God and is walking life and has that attitude toward his brother is in darkness. That's what we're talking about. Is that what you're talking about, Mark? Okay, yes.
Can you define what you mean by darkness? You mean someone's lost at that state of darkness?
He's not walking the light of God's revelation. And he is not in fellowship with God. Yes. You see, there's a whole lot more involved in the Christian life than most of us want to admit. And there's greater responsibility in the Christian life than most of us want to admit. You see, too many of us are playing Christians. It's a thing we do when we feel like it, when we feel like we don't do it. But for our from John's point of view, it's a full-time job. It's a thing that we do on. Now again, as I say, that doesn't mean if I don't match up to the perfect standard all the time, that doesn't mean that I'm lost or any such thing as that. But if I'm making this a habit pattern in my life, see, if I'm going on there, that's the present tense. See, the continual action. If I keep on saying I'm in fellowship and I keep on meeting, it doesn't mean now if I have a run-in with Joe Blow, Scott, here's a situation where our personalities clash, or maybe he's doing something that I don't like, and I tell him so, and he doesn't like the fact that I told him so, and we have a parting of the ways. See? Well, if that occurs, then if I'm walking the light, what am I going to do? What am I going to seek to do? As far as I'm concerned, what am I going to do?
Sooner or later, go to that person and try to make amends.
More likely sooner than later. In other words, I'm going to do what I can to reestablish that relationship. See? If I'm walking the light, I will seek, you see, the welfare of my brother. Now, if I'm walking in darkness and we haven't fallen out, I'll say, good riddance, I happen to like that guy anyway. See? And I'll just go right on and have no concern that we reestablish any kind of relationship. Now, we might not be able to establish, if he's walking in darkness, we'll not be able to reestablish the relationship. See? But if he's walking the light, and I'm walking the light, then we'll be able to find the solution. See, I am convinced of the fact that there is no problem that ever exists between two mature Christians that cannot be solved. See, by simply sitting down and talking about it. I'm convinced of that. But there's not any personal relationships, any problems, any misunderstandings that ever come up between two mature Christians that cannot be solved if the two will sit down, maybe in the presence of a third person, sometimes maybe take an art trip, but that problem, whatever, maybe should be able to be solved by mature Christians by simply talking, doing whatever has to be done to solve it. But now, if one or both, that sense of gender wouldn't be Christian, would they? But if one of the two is not walking the light, well, then there's no possibility of finding a solution to the problem. But if I'm in the light, if I'm in fellowship with God, and I'm seeking day by day to walk in the light, and I'm going to make every effort I can to reestablish a relationship with that person, I may never be able to do it. He may not choose to do so. But you see, my heart's right. And the only thing I can be responsible for is my heart. I can't determine for you. You and I have to go on out and try to do all I can to reestablish. If you don't want to, there's nothing I can do about that, as long as my heart's right. But if both of us walk in the light, we will both want to do it. We'll both want to come to an understanding, and we'll sit down. Now, we may never agree on the issue. See, it's not necessary that we always agree to be in fellowship. We may disagree on that issue, but you and I will still be brothers. And we'll not let that sever our relationship. There are a lot of things which I don't agree with somebody else about, but I'm certainly not going to let that rob me of the fellowship of that individual. And a lot of times, personality conflicts, yes, my personality says that I can get along with it, but I'm not going to let that destroy the fact that that's my brother or that's my sister. Right? Well, we may never agree on that issue, but we're going to be agreeable in that disagreement. But if one of the two's walk in darkness, there will be disagreeable. You'll be disagreeable in that disagreement. But the fellow walking in light will never be disagreeable. He may disagree, but he'll not be disagreeable. See what we're saying? Okay. So then it's new in that it's new in my experience. I have a different perspective now that I'm a Christian. I have the presence of the Spirit of God, which enables me, Jim, to love like I have not been able to love before. You see, it enables me to come to maturity in my doctrine. And that's when I'm able to love indiscriminately. That's when I'm able to love in spite of, not because of. And until that time, probably my love is going to be based the flat. I'm going to be based upon that response. I love you because you love me. You're kind to me, and I'm going to be kind to you. You do the things I like, and I try to do the things you like, and so therefore we minister to one another. But that's not the kind of love that's going to take us through whenever there comes this disagreement. See, this is why a lot of marriages don't make it past the 25th year. You do know that there is a crisis in the first year of marriage, and there's another crisis in the fifth year, somewhere around the fifth year. Then there'll be another one somewhere around the 10th or the 12th year. And there'll be a major crisis somewhere around the 25th year. That would be especially true when the children grow up and get in school. There'll be a crisis. And there'll be a big crisis when the last child leaves home. There'll be a crisis. Now, the reason why some of the marriages break up at that point, you see, it's been all on the level. It's been affection. It's been response. It's a mutual response. And now when these situations come that cause the one, you see, to love in spite of, not because of, but agape isn't there. Basis for that union is not there. That's why so many couples, at the 25th year, you hear a lot of them now, don't you? Been married 25 years and getting a divorce. Why? It's because they've never developed a love. And I don't believe this thing falling in and out of love. That's a lot of poppycock. You don't fall in and fall out of love. Because love is not something you fall into. Love is something you develop. And agape is that which you develop. And if you work at developing that kind of love, then whenever these differences come, when that last child was home, I used to think that was a lot of marketing. You think it is right now, too. real thing that'll light every man what he's talking about. That's what I used to think. But let me tell you something, it's true. When our last daughter left home, something happened. There was a boy there. Used to, I would think, oh, well, if ever been a place, I wonder if they ain't been bong, coming out of there. Well, I'd be glad when that happens. And I want you to know what had happened. I would have given anything to hear bing, bong, coming out of there. Something happens. And agape is that which enables you to spend. And agape enables you to spend all of the real differences. And if it's just for that, or you're not going to make it, because if you see that aspect of life soon dwindles if you're not very careful. After all, you can always find somebody just a little prettier, a little more handsome, gentle, or a brighter. You can always find it. But whenever it's agape, she doesn't even earn it. That's the thing that John's talking about here, that kind of love. Then in verse 10, I think we've got time for this. He talks about the skandalon. One loving his brother remains in life, and there is no skandalon. Now, the skandalon is a trigger on a trap. No stumbling block is found in the person who truly has agape. I put on the board the drawing of those various kinds of mock traps, you know, there's that elongated kind that I used to make, and you have all kinds of them, but every trap that I've ever seen has a trigger on it, somewhere. And the skandalon is the trigger on the trap. And John is affirming here then that the one who habitually, here again he's using the present participle, okay, the one who goes on loving for the gospel, his brother, remains, that is, this is the present tense, he keeps on remaining alive, and there is nothing in love that's going to serve as a trigger on a trap. You see, the point of it is this, Scott. He's getting ready to leave, but that's all right. See, I'm not going to let that interfere with our God. I love him in spite of that. I don't like what he's doing, but I like Scott. That's the vice, Andy.
That has to be agape.
You see, there is nothing in agape that's going to allow me to in any way ensnare my brother like the trigger on a trap. I'm not going to do anything that's going to bring any harm to any brother or sister in Christ. There's nothing in agape that will let me do that. Agape refuses to allow me to use you in any way to minister to my own needs. I will not do that. And more than that, there's nothing in the gospel that will ever permit me or allow me say or do anything towards you that in any way will harm you, detract from you. God won't let me do that because I'm going to love you. Now again, I may not like it, but you're getting ready to leave before class today. But I'm not going in any way, you see, to use you for my benefit or to harm you. See, but God won't let me do that. That's what he's saying. There is no reason for stumbling. There is no stumbling block in love. There's nothing in agape love that's going to cause any kind of fracture in my relationship with my brother. God will not let me have it. Although I may resist the very end while the person's doing it. Their attitude may be such that it just totally opposite of anything that's acceptable to me, but still, in all of this, agape is going to cause me to keep on giving myself the object of my love. I'm going to seek for the best, the object of my love. That's what John's talking about here. There's nothing in love. The fellow who keeps on loving is not in any way ever going to put a stumbling block or be a trigger on a trap for somebody else. Well, we'll take it from there. You may go, Scott.
Thanks, sir.
Should we return the toy?
Yeah.